This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 31st, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, key provisions of the health care reform law go into effect this week, but the battle over reproductive rights continues. After a string of deadly police shootings in Anaheim, residents call for reform at the city council.
There's been other shootings in the past, and we haven't really seen a clear response to the investigation, so it's time for an outside investigation to take place.
And are the Olympics a temporary tax haven for wealthy corporations? We'll look at the rules set up for big profit at the Summer Games. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The head of the United Nations Observer Mission convoy in Syria came under attack over the weekend. According to the UN, no one was hurt because the vehicles were covered in armor. Fighting between the military and anti-government forces continues, with the heaviest fighting still around the northern Syrian city of Aleppo. UNHCR spokesperson Melissa Fleming says many local residents have no means to flee the city or feel it's too dangerous to make the journey because of armed gangs and roadblocks.
We are trying our best to help the people in the schools. For example, there are 32 schools in Aleppo that we've identified, and in each of those schools, we've heard or witnessed that 250 to 350 people were packed inside, many of these families, kids. And then in university dormitories, there are a total of some 7,000 people staying in the dormitory rooms, hoping to seek safety from the continuing shelling and the continuing violence in the streets of Aleppo.
Both the rebels and government forces say they are controlling the battle in Aleppo. France takes over as rotating head of the UN Security Council tomorrow, August 1st, and says it will call for an emergency meeting on Syria. But with Russia and China still opposed to actions condemning Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, it's unclear what the UN can accomplish. At least 10 people were killed and dozens wounded when police loyal to ousted Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh took over the Interior Ministry in the country's capital. After a year of protests against his rule, Saleh stepped down earlier this year, but tensions remain. Reportedly, Saleh's nephew, who's in charge of the police's central security forces, sent officers to participate in a demonstration which precipitated the takeover of the ministry building. Saleh's supporters remain in control of the building and neighboring streets. Russian officials charged a well-known anti-corruption activist with stealing large sums of money from the government, a charge that could carry up to 10 years in prison. The move targets one of the opposition's most effective leaders. Ekaterina Danilova reports.
The Russian National Investigative Committee says it has evidence that Alexei Navalny stole 16 million rubles, or about $500,000, in a forestry deal when he worked for a regional governor in 2009. Navalny denies all the charges, saying such accusations are how the Kremlin deals with its critics, in an address to reporters after his appearance at the committee.
All the jokes about how Khodorkovsky stole all the oil and Navalny stole all the forests is about what has happened here. As far as I understand, the only sense of this is to make it so that today our wonderful first and second channels can say on the news that Navalny stole 16 million rubles.
The charges come amid a government crackdown on the opposition through a series of new laws. Police also roughly broke up unsanctioned anti-Putin protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg today, with dozens arrested. Navalny has filed a claim against the accusation in court, and the first hearing is scheduled for later this week. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
Power outages in India escalated today, leaving hundreds of millions without electricity. A 15-hour-long power outage on Monday affected 9 states. Shortly after the northern grid was restored, it went out again, along with a grid serving eastern and northeastern India. Hundreds of commuter and long-distance trains were stranded on the tracks, and close to 200 coal miners were trapped underground when the power to operate their pulley system failed. A report by a government panel investigating the power failure is due within 15 days. The Democratic Party may include support for same-sex marriage in their party platform at this year's convention. The Democratic Party Platform Draft Committee unanimously approved the language. It still has to be approved by the full platform committee, which meets in 2 weeks. On his program, The 700 Club, noted conservative commentator Pat Robertson says he believes the move will hurt the Democrats in this November's elections.
About 2% of the population are homosexual. 1% of the population lesbian. That's a tiny group. And every time this initiative has been brought to the ballot where the people have a chance to vote, they vote overwhelmingly in favor of traditional marriage. For the Democrats to go out on that limb, it just seems like to me that they are further alienating themselves from the mainstream of America. If that's what they want to do, fine, but it'll mean the death knell of their party, it seems like to me. And of course, that's what maybe they have a death wish.
The proposed language reportedly also opposes the Defense of Marriage Act and supports the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Democrats also announced that San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro will give the convention's keynote speech on opening night. Castro is the first Latino to be selected as keynote speaker. The Democratic National Convention begins on September 4th in Charlotte, North Carolina. And those are today's headlines. For Free Speech Radio News from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Key provisions of the Affordable Care Act take effect this week, including free screenings for cancer and domestic violence, affordable breastfeeding supplies and counseling, and full coverage of preventative care services, including contraception. Even though the Supreme Court recently upheld most of the health care reform law, the struggle for reproductive rights on Capitol Hill and across the country continues as the House of Representatives votes to ban some abortions in D.C. and a federal judge upholds Arizona's new abortion restrictions that legal and women's health groups call unconstitutional. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Surrounded by her fellow Democrats and women's health advocates at a Capitol Hill conference, Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski outlined the importance of the Women's Preventative Health Care Amendment's upcoming implementation.
Tomorrow, August 1st, women who in need of preventive health care services will be able to take a giant step forward to have access to the care they need without the barriers of cost or discrimination.
The amendment requires insurance companies to cover a range of women's health services, from HIV and HPV testing to breastfeeding supplies to contraception, without charging a copay or premium. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius and others called the implementation a new day for women's health in America. But not all women in the U.S. will benefit, and the 47 million who will may have to wait months or years. Karen Davenport with the National Women's Law Center explains some of the fine print.
It's women who have private health insurance coverage that is through a new health insurance plan, which means that it has made some significant changes to its benefits since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, so since March of 2010. A lot of the women who have private health insurance coverage, particularly employer-sponsored coverage, will be seeing these benefits, just will not necessarily be happening for them on August 1st. It will happen as their plan year turns over.
Religious institutions and affiliated schools and hospitals will be able to refuse to cover their employees' contraceptive care for at least an additional year, while the health department reaches a final ruling on the issue. Efforts in some states to allow private companies to do the same are gaining ground. On Friday, a federal court upheld the right of a small air conditioning company to opt out of the preventative care mandate. The business's Catholic owner said providing his workers with insurance for contraception violated his Catholic beliefs. But Marcia Greenberger with the National Women's Law Center says it's unfair for female employees that a non-religious private company who pay into their health plans to be denied certain services.
Women need to be able to get access to needed health care just like men can. And of course, one of the things we have to make sure of is that this does respect women's health needs and women's own religious principles and beliefs too.
Reproductive rights restrictions are also being challenged in Arizona, including a law allowing any private employer to refuse to cover birth control in an insurance plan, and another banning all abortions more than 20 weeks after a woman's last menstrual cycle. Janet Krebs, a lead attorney suing Arizona on behalf of the Center for Reproductive Rights, told FSRN why that bill is unconstitutional.
It bans abortions before viability, the point at which a fetus could live independently from the pregnant woman. And that is directly contrary to what the United States Supreme Court has said. It's women's constitutional rights to have abortions up until that point in pregnancy.
Arizona women are only exempt from the ban if they face a dire and possibly life-threatening emergency, but not if their health or the health of their child is at risk.
If a woman finds out that her fetus has a problem that's going to result in it dying shortly after birth, if this woman doesn't get her pregnancy terminated by 20 weeks, she would have no choice in Arizona but to continue the pregnancy. All along, people asking her when she's due and asking her if the baby's going to be a boy or a girl, and she and her family suffering, knowing that at the end of the process, the baby would die during childbirth or shortly thereafter.
The Center for Reproductive Rights and the ACLU joined a group of Arizona gynecologists in suing the state, but a judge dismissed their challenge Monday. The groups are now asking the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for an emergency injunction to block the law's implementation before it takes effect on Thursday. Krebs says a ruling against Arizona could discourage other state legislatures from passing similar laws, but says legal challenges will continue even if the abortion ban goes into effect. Alice Holstein, FSRN.
Today in Anaheim, community groups are calling on the city council to adopt reforms that they say would more democratically reflect the city's Latino residents. The recent shooting of an unarmed man and police force used against residents have refocused attention on police conduct in the Orange County city. Earlier this month, the Southern Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union and Latino leaders filed a lawsuit saying the city's at-large elections violate the California state voting law, resulting in inadequate representation. Critics of the lawsuit point out that Latinos have served on the council in the past, and according to the Orange County Register, one current member, Lori Galloway, said she is Filipina and Latina. For more, we're joined by Martin Lopez. He's a resident of Anaheim and a community organizer with the Unite Local 11 Union. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to speak, Dorian.
Good to have you on the program. Begin by describing the community in South and North Anaheim where the recent shootings took place.
These communities are actually, I would say, almost 98% Latino communities, very low-income neighborhoods where violence and all kinds of lack of resources and lack of representation has been occurring for decades now.
And you are going to the city council today. What are you calling for?
We're calling for the city to approve the redraw the city into districts. We believe that district elections will provide a real voice to our communities. We are saying that the city structure lacks representation of our communities through the current city council. There's four city council members, and three of them, plus the mayor, live in Anaheim Hills, which is a rich area, while the center and while the south and north of the county and the west have no representation whatsoever.
And how does the structure of the city council, how people are elected to the city council, how does that influence the representation you're talking about?
Well, we're talking about a city that is growing rapidly. And while the Latino community represents 53%, more than half, only a third of the Latino voters are registered to vote, although it makes it impossible because it's what is called a city at large elections, it's impossible for any Latino to ever get elected, given all the special interests that come from within the city or outside the city to influence the political arena in our city.
Well, a lot of attention was focused on Anaheim after these killings by the police, but this issue is not new to Anaheim residents. Talk about the issue of the police's role in the community there and what residents have been going through.
Well, the community is really scared and is afraid of the police, and at this point they're angry because when police don't only come to really protect the citizens of these neighborhoods, but they actually come to harass them, and anyone that appears to be Latino, brown, or bald, or have a tattoo will be shot without any concern whatsoever.
And how would a remake of the city council or having different city elected leaders on the city council, in your view, address that issue?
Well, through having a more fair city council, we believe that there could be some reform in the police department, where there is also a very low percentage of Latino police officers, as well as all these incidents, and as well as when you have a closer representative to home and a council member that has less residents per to be in charge of, so then the communication is open. And besides, all the resources are more dedicated to Anaheim Hills, where there's more libraries, more community centers, and more green space, while our communities lack all of that.
And as you're describing a mid-range or longer-term solution, in your view, to this police action, specifically to these shootings, some groups have been calling for city leaders to launch investigations or independent investigations into what happened, including calling on California Attorney General Kamala Harris to launch an investigation. What would you like to see from city leaders about these recent events?
Yes, we strongly support all those organizations, including Presente.org and a group of mothers that are out there that have lost their youth through these police shootings. We are encouraging that Kamala Harris comes and does an investigation because, again, you know, there's been other shootings in the past, and we haven't really seen a clear response to the investigation. So it's time for an outside investigation to take place, and we support that 100%.
Martin Lopez is a resident of Anaheim, and he's also a community organizer with the Unite Local 11 Union. Mr. Lopez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to speak.
Recent elections in a disputed territory between Azerbaijan and Armenia have both highlighted tensions in the region and offered hope. The heavily militarized area in the South Caucasus, called Nagorno-Karabakh, is near strategic gas pipelines and was the site of a bloody war in the 1990s between Armenia and Azerbaijan. But officials say the elections are an achievement of democratic standards. FSRN's MJ Del Valle looks at whether democracy could make a difference for this republic's stability and its relationship with the rest of the world.
School teacher Hanahid Danilian lives in Talish, a village of about 400 residents close to the border with Azerbaijan. She says she wants stability for her community.
Whoever wins needs to know that we are a boundary village and we need protection.
Danilian's words reflect the priorities for many people living in Nagorno-Karabakh. In her small village, soldiers are often present. Nearby, shootings take place between Azerbaijani and Armenian and Karabakhian soldiers. This is one of the places where tensions with Azerbaijan are more obvious. Danilian's husband, Karen Kavalian, stresses the uncertainty some live with.
No one can predict what is going to happen. Every day we expect the war may start and we are ready. We don't know when.
Voters re-elected the incumbent president, former security chief Bako Sahakian. Following the results, he said the elections were a manifestation of the nation's high civil stance and wisdom and vow to be consistent in solving the existing problems, eliminating drawbacks and shortcomings. But human rights activists say Nagorno-Karabakh effectively exists under a state of martial law. The NGO Freedom House ranks it as not free due to restrictions on civil liberties, freedom of association, and media censorship. The group Silvana Havdan-Kolotskovska says they hope government leaders prioritize reforms.
Regardless of the recognized status, there is no reason to assume that Nagorno-Karabakh could not improve its rating in our survey, could not improve its status. We see no evidence under the last government, under the incumbent president's previous term, of a great deal of commitment to making these changes.
Change was the key word in the recent presidential elections. But some say they have already seen progress, including teacher Hanahi Danielian.
The village is developing. A supermarket is about to open in the village. Who said that the situation is getting worse? The school is operating, and my three daughters went to school here and graduated from university.
Peace talks have continued since Armenia and Azerbaijan signed a ceasefire in 1994. But so far, diplomatic attempts have not yielded results, and Nagorno-Karabakh remains unrecognized by the international community. This makes it difficult for the elected leaders of Nagorno-Karabakh, according to Robert Avetisian, who serves as the territory's permanent representative in the United States.
The democratic processes here, we can say now for sure that they have become irreversible. It's easier, at least it should be easier, for a democratic nation, for a democratic people, for a democratic state to get recognized.
Another key issue is the return of hundreds of thousands of refugees who fled during the war, including most of the Azeri population. The presidential candidates did not address the return of the Azerbaijani refugees during their campaigns, and some officials say their return may trigger fatal clashes and even a new war. But some young people, like student Anoush Gavalian, say things in the future may be different.
I can imagine the return of Azeri people here, just in one case, when they will come here as Azeris, but will accept the independence of Nagorno-Karabakh, and also they will want to get the citizenship of Karabakh.
Different sides describe the results of the elections as a triumph of democracy, an act of provocation, step towards stronger civil society, an illegitimate poll, and so on. These responses to the presidential elections in Nagorno-Karabakh demonstrate the polarized attitudes towards this republic. While leaders from all sides cautiously approach a peace process, residents like school teacher Anahit Danielian say the insecurity of the region is part of their everyday lives.
The
school is working and they are working, she says. There is not fear in the village, not even from the fighting. Their hope is the army. As long as the army defends their borders, she says, they'll sleep calmly. MJ Delbaye, FSRN, Nagorno-Karabakh.
The Olympic Games in London are underway, and projections of the event's costs have risen steadily. At first, London officials estimated $3.6 billion. Now they say it will cost $15 billion. And according to an investigation by Sky News that considers other costs like land acquisition, that could reach nearly $40 billion. As the true cost of the sporting event for the people of the UK is yet to be seen, corporations and private developers already stand to make large profits from the Games as the result of a temporary tax break that has essentially created a tax haven during the Olympics. For more, we're joined by Naomi Fowler of the Tax Justice Network and producer of the TaxCast, a 15-minute monthly podcast with news and analysis on tax havens and corruption. She joins us from London. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the International Olympic Committee and how we got to the point where there is this temporary tax haven status at the Olympic site.
Where it starts is that the International Olympic Committee insists that any aspiring cities wanting to host the Olympics must sign a contract with them, agreeing to provide, among other things, air-conditioned chauffeured limousines, dedicated traffic lanes for VIPs, and there's a lot of them, and most importantly for this our purposes today, no taxes to pay for their Olympic corporate partners. But just to be clear about that, the International Olympic Committee is expected to earn about £2.7 billion from the Olympic Games. It's going to be paying zero tax in the UK, the host country, and minimal tax in Switzerland, a tax haven where they're registered. And meanwhile, they and their partners, their Olympic partners, which are huge corporations, very, very well-known, big-name corporations, are going to benefit from probably the biggest infrastructure project in Europe, massive mobilisation of security and policing in the UK, all paid for largely by the British taxpayer.
Well, who stands to benefit most from this deal? Who are these large corporate partners?
Right, well, there are several Olympic partners and sponsors. These are some of the largest companies in the world, as I said. McDonald's, which is, it's hard to believe that it's actually the official food sponsor of an event which is supposed to be about health and fitness. We've got companies like Adidas, General Electric, EDF, BP, Lloyds, Coca-Cola. And these are all companies that are prolific serial tax haven users.
So how much of a tax loss are we talking about?
At a conservative estimate, the Ethical Consumer magazine, who was the one that first highlighted and researched this temporary tax haven at the Olympics, they have estimated the loss to the nation, to the Treasury in tax revenue, and I say again, its conservative estimate is around £700 million. So that's $1 billion, I think, more or less, roughly.
Now, we've talked about the potential losses due to these tax breaks and the loss in revenue that the people of the UK could suffer as a result of this. Now, politicians and supporters of the Olympics have long pointed out the positive aspects of the Olympics, the promise of public parks, of permanent jobs coming into East London. What are the long-term plans for this site?
There were a number of bids from various places to buy the Olympic site, to develop it in different ways. There was an excellent bid from the Wellcome Trust, which was including a science and technology park that was going to be some kind of a Silicon Valley of Europe. They were going to build thousands of units of social housing, which is very much needed in East London. There was going to be a museum, up to 7,000 jobs. And this bid was declined in favour of a higher bidder, which happened to be a consortium led by the Qatari royal family. So what's going to happen, I suspect, is it's going to become an entirely privately owned, privately controlled private estate.
Now, there has been a reaction. There's a campaign to name and shame companies. Talk quickly about that campaign and its successes.
Initially, the Ethical Consumer magazine started contacting some of the corporate Olympic partners, and eventually McDonald's was the first company who very quietly posted a very short statement to say that they would not be making their tax exemption claim in the Olympic site. Then a campaign was begun around that time by 38 Degrees. They collected, I think, 250,000 signatures in quite a short time to try to pressure the other companies. And we've got to a position now where I think it's now standing at 9 Olympic partners have stated that they won't be claiming the Olympic tax exemption. Now, I should offer a word of caution. They are not offering yet to open their books and prove that that's going to be the case after the Olympics are over. So the next stage, as far as the Tax Justice Network's concerned, will be to follow up on that.
Naomi Fowler is from the Tax Justice Network and producer of the TaxCast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can listen to Naomi Fowler's full report on the temporary tax haven at the Olympics on the TaxCast, the podcast from the Tax Justice Network, at tackletaxhavens.com/taxcast, or go to fsrn.org for more. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Nell Abram and Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Andrew Stelzer. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Eder and Zane Carisley. Washington, D.C. intern is Nett Smith-Savadoff. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.